When during this period in 1913, were you aware that the National American was not all that eager to put this much effort out on a national amendment?
Was that what?
Were you aware that the officers, like Dr. Shaw and so forth, of the National American, did not want all this effort put out for a national amendment, that they wanted more state-to-state campaigns?
Well, I don't think they did. I think that they were back of us.
Well, they were back of you up to a point, and I'm just trying to fix in time where that point was, where they felt that...
For instance, we had first of all, in our first big procession, they headed it.
Right.
Then our subsequent processions, they... I don't know whether they came down physically or not, but I think that, as far as I know, we had their backing.
Yeah.
Then... that first year we had a meeting, I remember, in a theater in Washington.
Yeah.
And Dr. Shaw came down and was the principal speaker at that meeting. It was in the summer.
Oh, in the summer?
The Columbia Theater, I think we had
the National Council of Women Voters met August 13th.
No, that's not it. That was totally different. That's something we formed on our own. Or got to form. Then the...
Well, they had a meeting in the Columbia Theater in December.
Well, no, but that's their convention.
That's their annual convention. That
and we, good. You know, we got up that convention. We paid $1,000, I never should forget ourselves, that we had to raise the money for the hall where it was held. And I was invited out to Dr. Shaw's home in Pennsylvania when they were planning the convention. And I said that I thought it would be helpful to have the National Convention in Washington because we wanted to direct as much attention as we could to the federal amendment, and the convention could go to see the president and it would be helpful to us, I thought. And then they were always this way, and then they said we would get up to the convention and would pay all the bills for the convention. They would come to Washington. So Dr. Shaw was heartily in favor of what we were doing up to that point.
Why wouldn't they share some of the responsibility for financing it with you?
Well, it's common in most women's organizations for the local place to have a convention. I suppose it is with all groups, American Legion, everybody else, I imagine, do that way, that the local people entertain and they bear the expense. Well, since they're local, with such a tiny little group that couldn't do anything,
mm-hmm.
I suppose that it was natural what they wanted us to do, which we did. Now, the first whisper of protest that I ever heard, there may have been whispers going on that I didn't hear about, I do think we made one mistake, which was that we didn't keep in constant, say almost every other day, connection, correspondence by telephone or by letter or by going up personally to make reports to the national leaders who were up there in the New York headquarters. I think if we had done so, we would have perhaps never had to have the two groups, because we were working so hard and had so little money and so little thought of anything but what to do the next morning,
mm-hmm.
how ever to get through the things we'd undertaken,
mm-hmm.
that we just proceeded as though we were doing it, which we were, and that we would have the backing of everybody. But by the time of the convention, the national treasurer, her name was Mrs. Stanley McCormick, and Mrs. Kath, made a protest at the convention against what we were doing, which is the first thing that I realized it. Perhaps it was dumb not to realize it before, but I didn't.
That was the convention in Washington.
One that we had gotten up, and I remember our desire to save money, we asked Mrs. Kent if she would entertain all the national boards. She had a big house mm-hmm. and was the wife of a congressman and was very, 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 very wealthy. Mm-hmm. So she said she would.
Well, she had been a member for a long time, too.
Of what?
Hadn't she? Of NASA? She was on their congressional committee before you were.
Well, there was no division. She
I know. I said she'd been a member of NAWSA.
Anyway, this convention was coming, and I asked her, since we had the responsibility of financing it, including the entertaining of all members of the National Board, would she entertain them at her home so that we wouldn't have to pay an immense hotel bill? And she said she would, gladly. And then I remember they said, they sent us word that they couldn't go to a private home, that they had to meet constantly every moment on, in any way connected with the campaign, and pay all the expenses. And I think they've carried out this arrangement with the greatest possible honor and conscientiousness. They have never turned in a bill for even a 25-cent expenditure, and they have paid all the bills, and they have no debts to come back to the National American. Every bill is paid that they have ever incurred. And since this is what we asked them to do, I don't see why wouldn't we now turn around and criticize it. That was her point. And of course, she was a very influential member of the National Board. Mm-hmm. And then Miss Gillette, this lawyer that we'd gotten to help us from the very beginning and who became the treasurer of our first committee.
Oh, yeah.
It may be we raised $27,000 for that procession and more later. I remember $27,000 was raised for something.
There was a $27,000 total figure raised up through November of that year that I saw in a treasurer's report.
Was it?
And I think you had given that figure because you had 11 months of the year. And I think
it was the $27,000 that the treasurer was having all this dispute about.
Yeah.
So whatever the sum was, and so then Miss Gillette got up, and she said, I was treasurer for the for this movement here in Washington, from the beginning, from the first penny that was raised, until this procession was finished. Then another treasurer succeeded me, and I want to say from my experience that the really phenomenal frugality was displayed, it seemed to me, by the people who were running this campaign. And she spoke of general approval. And she was an important woman because the dean of the only woman's law school in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So she spoke for us. And then we saw there was a ripple of this. Some people weren't our friends. We could see that. So then when the convention was over, they asked me, this board, if I would continue for another year, but sever my relations with the Congressional Union, which they thought was the one that was wagging the dog, or wagging the tail, or whatever the thing is.
Oh, or something, yeah. Oh.
Because the group that was wagging them, anyway, had gotten out the paper. It was the Congressional Union's paper. And we had by this time, we're using the name Congressional Union for Women's Suffrage. And when the way that happened that we got a Congressional Union was that when we began to see how much it was going to cost us to get up a procession, we'd never gotten up one, we didn't know what these things would cost. And we did proceed, I think, with great frugality, but still we did have a certainly tremendous number of bills. And I remember Mr. Lett coming to me and saying, really in terror, I can't stand for these bills that you're coming bringing in to me every single day. We never, never, never can pay them. And then a little while she came and she said, well, I see, I don't understand how it's done, but that you are getting in a sufficient amount of money always to cover your bills. And so I withdraw my objection. You only know what you're about. And so she supported us very loyally at the convention. Well, when we discovered that if we wrote to somebody in a state, the state president would write back and say, now you've taken away one of my chief financial supporters. and I have to win this referendum, do my best to win the referendum, and I need every penny I can get. So when we got protests from any place we tried to get any money, we thought, well, we'll form a little group who won't be involved in a state referendum campaign and who can do everything they can to help us by supplying members for our lobbying work and for our deputations and for our fundraising and so on. Well, now, the National American had a series of memberships branches could belong to, and I remember that one of them required you to have 300 members before you could be a branch in that category, and you had to pay so much, whatever the sum was, I don't remember the sum, to the National every year. So we applied to be affiliated with them in this class, and we were accepted, and then when we first started, when we began, which was in probably April or May, first year, 1913. And then it became a question of we thought maybe we'd get 300 people and ask them each one to give whatever the sum was we had to give, we'll say $10 each or something like that. And we called people on the phone and we got enough to satisfy this requirement and the money requirement, and then applied to be an affiliated branch. At the very beginning, when we were first formed, this was. And so then we didn't know what to call ourselves. And I remember that Mrs. Bennett, who was the national secretary, proposed this name, Congressional Union for Woman Suffrage. I didn't think, and I still don't think it was very much of a name, but still, since she'd proposed it and was the national secretary, we thought it would be a good thing to take it. So we did call ourselves Congressional Union for Woman Suffrage. And I remember we discussed it so much, and we said, well, we don't know whether we have the right to say Congressional Union. We're not connected in any way with Congress. And I remember Mrs. Kent saying, oh, that'll be all right. We have a congressional
bootblack?
Person who shines your boots, whatever.
Bootblack.
Bootblack,
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
We have a congressional bootblack, and we have a congressional this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't we have a Congressional Union for Woman Suffrage?
Yeah.
So we said, all right, if you think the congressman won't object, we'll call it that. So we did. Well, then it had raised, at least through the efforts of this group, we had raised the money we had gotten in, and we'd gotten the people through this efforts of this group who'd gone on all our delegations and all our processions, and they were sort of our backbone.
Mm-hmm.
And they were almost all D.C. people who had no connection with the old National American, never had,
mm-hmm.
So there was no deflection from them, and who had no state referendum campaigns to be diverting them, and seemed to be working all right.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't expand it or try to make it any bigger. We just tried to get the number we were required by their regulations to have, which was only, I think, about 300. So then they said, no, if you continue as chairman, you have to have undivided loyalty, and it must be to the National Association and their National Committee, and not divided with the Congressional Union. We said, well, the Congressional Union's only purpose is to raise money and get members to finance the Congressional Committee's campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't see any conflict at all. But I said, I don't think I could function without some kind of a group to help us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't want to take it, and I don't want to sort of disown a group that I've created and has given us such enormous support.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, then I would, I wouldn't be chairman if that was, first of all, I'd gone down to be chairman only for a year, and it had been a pretty big expense,
mm-hmm.
personal expense, to my family and to me, and as well as taking every moment of your time and your strength and everything else. So I just said, I think I'd better not do it then. And they said, all right, then we'd like you to go on the committee all the same, but we don't want you to be chairman. So I said, oh, that's all right, I'll certainly be glad to continue on the committee. Then they said, now we'll ask Lucy Burns. And Lucy Burns said about the same thing I said. She wouldn't. I don't know whether they put her on the committee, but anyway, they asked to be chairman. She said no, she wouldn't be chairman. And then we had a period with no chairman. And then they announced one day that they decided on Mrs. Medill McCormick, and she had agreed to be the chairman. Well, we were very delighted, because when we started our first little effort, I remember getting out the procession, she was one of the first people from over the country that, without any solicitation, sent us $100 to help with our first procession.
Ah.
And she had always helped, always. And when, at the time of this national convention in Washington, a delegation had gone, which we had organized and planned way back when I'd gone up to see Dr. Shaw at her home in Pennsylvania, a delegation had requested an interview with the president. And Dr. Shaw, of course, led it as the president. And I stood right beside her, I presume at her request, I wouldn't have certainly done so otherwise, and listened to this wonderful speech she made to the president. And Mrs. Medill McCormick was one of those who helped me get up this delegation to the president. And we'd gone to see various people, newspaper people and all kinds of people, when we were trying to get the appointment, which we hadn't gotten too easily. So I thought
she... Was this President Taft?
What?
Was this back, I'm not sure what time you're speaking of. Was this President Taft? The time?
Oh, no, this was Wilson.
This was Wilson? Okay.
You see, he was Wilson. Wilson, this was end of 1913.
This is still 13.
And okay. He came in as president.
Yeah, I know. I just wasn't sure whether you had flashed back or not.
No.
Okay.
So, we thought this was a very wise appointment, and we were very happy over it. And Mrs. Medill McCormick immediately asked me to be a member of her committee. Well, I'd already been appointed by the National Board. And I asked her to be a member of our Congressional Union Committee, and she accepted right away. So we said, now we'll have complete harmony, because I'll be on their board and she'll be on our board, and there won't be any possibility of conflict.
I see.
So it seemed to me very good. And by this time, I decided I would take a little rest. Now we've gotten the whole Congressional Committee fixed up and the Congressional Union going forward. And although I'd agreed and expected to go home at the end of the first year, I still didn't see exactly how I could go. So anyway, I decided to go home to my own home in Morristown, New Jersey, and just rest for a time.
What you just told me happened before their national convention or after?
National convention.
Okay.
So, accepting the part of the delegation of the president, which was in the convention.
Yeah, yeah.
During the convention.
Okay.
One of the convention activities. So then I went home, and Lucy Burns took over the responsibility of the Washington work.
Mm-hmm.
And almost the first thing that happened was, that I got a letter from her saying that the most unbelievable thing had occurred, that Mrs. Medill McCormick, without consultation with anybody as far as we knew, had introduced a new amendment to the Constitution, Senator Shopworth of Colorado putting it in the Senate, and Mitchell Palmer of Pennsylvania putting it in the House, both of whom were our very good supporters, exceptionally good supporters, mm-hmm. And that this amendment was one that would divide the whole of Congress into two groups, those supporting one, those supporting the other, because one was to give women the vote and the other was to give women the right to a referendum on the subject to the male voters of the state on the collection of a sufficient number of signatures. Which seemed to us almost unthinkable. Well, Mrs. Medill McCormick took the position when I got back and we went into the thing. She was the daughter of Mark Hanna. You know who he was?
Oh, he was a big power in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes. It was Cleveland, but in Ohio.
Yeah.
He was one of the political bosses of the Republican Party, national.
Yeah.
and it was a great political power. And she was surrounded. She married Medill McCormick up in Chicago, but she was really surrounded by her father's, among other people, by her father's co-workers. And they had convinced her that as you looked over the world, there was almost no place where women could vote. There were a few Western states in our union. At that time, they were mainly, there weren't very many, you know, Wyoming, Idaho, Utah, Colorado. It's a small group. Mm-hmm. And in Russia, Finland was a province of Russia, and they could vote there. And I'm not quite clear, I don't remember at this moment exactly what the situation was in New Zealand and Australia, but I think there was some problems with it. But as you looked over the whole world, the whole globe, these were the only places women were voting. And they convinced her this was an impossible thing to take a great nation like the United States would go out of step with the rest of the world. She was thoroughly convinced of it. And that if by getting the referendum on in each state, maybe that strength could be built up and it could be done. But the main thing to do was to get the possibility of the East State referendum. Well, we told her we didn't agree with that at all. And
by this time, had you come back to Washington?
Yes, I came back right away when I got the message of this terrible thing. And we put by this time we had our paper, and I think you'll find it in this issue, that these volumes that you have, the editorials that we began to put week after week, mm-hmm. our editorials were on the shelf with Palmer. That was a big division. And then the Little Women's Congressional Union met together, the leaders on the way, decide what to do. And a great many of them said, well, we think we better disband. We can't fight this great National American one. It wasn't a very big one. Still, it was so big compared to us.
Oh, really?
And they said, just a few of us, we can't go forth and try to put this amendment through. And if these other people want it, they all want this. They voted this. So we said, well, we'll go up and talk to the National Board about this and see if we couldn't change their point of view.
What was Lucy Burns one who felt that it was too much to fight?
Oh, no. She was always a very belligerent person. She was always quite ready for a fight. But so we went up to the National Board, made an appointment to meet with them. And I think all of our people, all of our leading people on our committee, I know Mrs. William Kent went up, Mrs. Mm-hmm. Lawrence Lewis went.
Mm-hmm.
I went.
Was Maud Wood Park?
No, she wasn't in the picture then. I never heard of her at that time.
Okay.
Then their National Board met. Miss Jane Addams came from Chicago, and Dr. Shaw, and Mrs. Dennett, and their National Treasurer. Now, I remember the National Treasurer sat there, this Mrs. McCormick, at the meeting, and she took her chair and placed it so her back was to the group. And she sat there throughout the, seeing only her back, to show her complete severing of herself from everything that was going on. She wouldn't have even had a conversation with us, I guess.
Hmm.
So, of course, Miss Adams was always very pacific, and we were very pacific. And it seemed to us that I didn't see how anybody could, it seemed to me, just betray this movement that had begun so many, many, many years before, and that the amendment before Congress at this time that we were working for, you know, that came up when we first began our first procession as to what amendment we would work for. The whole national didn't even have any idea what they wanted to work for.
Mm-hmm.
So we appointed a committee. I appointed a committee and asked them to draw up the right amendment for us to work for when we were having our first procession. We demanded an amendment to the United States Constitution and franchise. We didn't know what amendment or how to draw it up or anything about it. And Mary Beard took the chairmanship. And she came in a few days. You know who she was, Mary Beard?
Oh, yes. Charles the Beard's historian.
Wife. Yes, Charles Beard's wife. Well, and she was on our first board when we formed our Congressional Union. So Mrs. Beard came back and she said, and she got people to be on the board that were competent to judge this. What we should, you see, we hadn't any idea that there could be any dispute. We just took for granted what Miss Anthony had put in was the thing that they'd always worked for, and Mrs. Kennedy worked for, and then we would just keep on. But when this question arose, what would we work for? We then pointed this committee to see what we'd better work for. So Mrs. Beard made the report from her committee that we ought to stick to the Susan B. Anthony original committee, original amendment. So here we were. We were the only group. We were sticking to the one that had been introduced year after year, and we didn't see how we could make it better. And we didn't want to start and work for just the right to have a referendum to the men of a state, where no woman would be enfranchised by that. So we came back defeated from the National Board. They didn't seem to have any good reason, but they said they'd appointed this committee, and their committee, Mrs. McGill McCormick, had vast political experience and great political wisdom at her command through her father's affiliations, and it seemed the wise thing to do, and they stuck to it. Although they hadn't been consulted by Mrs. McCormick and hadn't known she was going to do it. It was a strange attitude for them to take. And maybe again, if we had kept in more daily contact with them, we could have averted it. But that's the way it was. So we very seriously considered whether we hadn't better just give it up and disband and go home and let them go ahead and do the best they could. But we finally, all of us agreed that every one of us came to the same conclusion, that we'd better turn in and try to make another organization. Because then we were only an affiliate ourselves, you know, of the old National American. And it would be pretty hard for the National American to be trying to put one measure through Congress and have one of their affiliates trying to put another through.
Yeah.
So we said the only thing to do is to make ourselves a separate, completely separate organization. And I think they came to the same conclusion, because we got a letter from them asking that, or suggesting that since we were paying rather a high amount of money to them, we could change into a category where we would pay less.
Oh.
You probably know all this.
No.
So they said, you just send in your resignation whatever affiliate you are.
I see.
And then send at the same time an application to be in another group, and we'll just transfer you. So we sent in the resignation and the request for membership in another classification, where the expense wouldn't be so great. And they accepted our resignation, but they didn't accept our application for the new one. So we were out, you see. We were just put out by this device.
Yeah. But you had already decided that you wanted to be completely separate.
Well, we didn't so much. We hadn't really expected to continue. We wanted to have unity in the movement.
Yeah.
But we had expected to go our way and continue as a group to work for our old amendment.
Yeah.
We decided to do it, but it was rather a hard decision to make, because we didn't have any money, and our individual people didn't have any money, and we were all exhausted by 1 year's campaign. We've gone at a terrific pace. So, anyway, we voted that. And all of our own committee, our old congressional committee, stood with us. Mrs. Kent went with us, and everybody who'd been on the old committee, every single person, stayed with us. And so we then were the Congressional Union for Women's Suffrage, as in as a new independent organization, not affiliated with anybody. And that was, I think, in the late spring of 14.
Okay.
Then we had this constant conflict because we would use we demand amendment to the United States Constitution enfranchising women. They would say, we demand the passage of the Shafworth-Palmer, mm-hmm. giving women the right to referendum and so on this subject. It was the acme of the complicated for the congressmen and for the women of the country. Mm-hmm. So then they held what they called the Mississippi Conference, which was, I guess, an annual conference at the end of that time. It was a conference of all the states around the Mississippi. It was held in Iowa.
And this was the NAWSA's?
Yes, the National... Well, it was this Mississippi Conference was under the auspices of the states in the Mississippi region belonging to the old National, because nobody belonged to anything else. There wasn't any other thing to belong to. Mm-hmm. And I went out to the conference to try to get this conference to endorse the old Susan B. Anthony Amendment. And I remember on the way out, I went with Mrs. Glendower Evans, who was a very, very, very prominent woman in Boston, belonging to the old National American. Mm-hmm. And she was passionately for continuing the old amendment campaign. Mm. So she wanted very much to go out, and I went with her. Or she went with me, however it may be. Mm-hmm.
What was her name, Alice?
Her name, Glendower, G-L-E-N-D-O-W-E-R, Evans. She lived in Boston, was a prominent member of the old National American. Well, then we stopped in Hull House on the way out, because Mrs. Evans was a great personal friend of Miss Jane Addams. And she was passionate about this, abandoning the old Susan B. Anthony Amendment. And so we explained it to Miss Addams that night, which is what you have to do all the time, explaining to the people who are important, but that's what takes so much time. But we did do it with Miss Addams, keep her informed. And we were her guests that night. And she devoted all her time to looking into it. And I don't think she took any active part. She was on the national board, and so she was sort of bound to what they were doing. But she was, we had a feeling that she was very sympathetic with what we were doing. So then we went on to the Mississippi Conference, and we met in the rooms of different people during the conference, where all the delegations from one state would meet. And I would go up and talk to them, and somebody would go up and talk on the other side about the two amendments, trying to influence people as much as we could to stick by the old amendment. Well, then when it came to the floor of the conference, somebody got up and said, we would like Miss Paul to explain to us what this... I wasn't on the program, what this whole mix-up's about and so on. And up got one of the officers at Mississippi Conference and said, well, Miss Paul's been very ill, and we don't want to tax her by making her make a report or something. So I sat and listened in great astonishment to this, but I didn't say anything.
Had you been ill at all?
This time that I went up to, when I went up to take a rest, I think I went to the hospital, and it was some kind of an intestinal trouble I'd gotten by eating some kind of apples or something.
Oh.
So my mother arranged for me to go into the hospital and try to get this thing cleared up, which they did, whatever it was. And I wasn't very seriously sick. And I believe I did that during this time I was going to take this rest. I'd sort of forgotten that anything when I heard I was very ill. So I didn't say anything, and they went on with all their reasons for the Shafworth-Palmer. And then they got up a woman from Minnesota named Mrs. Alden Potter. And I had gone out to Minnesota and spoken before their branch, because we were starting then to go over the country and speak before every branch in the country if we could. And I'd spoken there before the Minnesota ones, and Mrs. Potter invited me to be her guest at her home. She was a Christian Scientist, very devout one, and gave me a Christian Science, what's the thing called? Mrs. Eddy's book, whatever it is, Science and Health. And we became very good friends by staying there. And so she said she would leave the old National American. She would never work for this new thing. And a large section of their Minnesota people joined us in our campaign for the old amendment. I guess almost everybody did. And so Mrs. Potter got up and said, well, Miss Paul's sitting here. She doesn't seem to me too ill to explain this thing to us or something. she got up. And I wasn't a member. You see, I wasn't from Mississippi.
Yeah.
Region, and I don't know that I was. I rather think I just went. I can't remember that I had an invitation to go. I don't believe I would have had. So I did try to explain it, and I think then Mrs. Potter said, well, the Minnesota people were all of their board and practically the whole group were for continuing with the old amendment. And so there was not any unanimous support, I think, for Mississippi. Certainly wasn't any for our point of view, and I don't think there was any for any point of view. They just heard it all, and they disbanded. But anyway, I was regarded as a pariah, an outcast in every possible way at this convention. So we went up, everybody went back to Chicago, and in order to get back to their respective places.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody stayed at the same hotel there. Most of the people, I think.
Oh, uh-huh.
Just for convenience.
Yeah.
Whatever the hotel was that was recommended to us. So I remember going down in the morning to breakfast. And here were all these people from all the different states in the Union. And I remember not one human being spoke to me. And I just felt such an outcast. And for a long time we were regarded in that way.
Gosh.
Howsoever, people like these Minnesota group. And then Mrs. Hooker, Donald Hooker, who's Catherine Hepburn, you know, is her niece. Mrs. Hooker was the sister of Mrs. Hepburn up here in Connecticut, who was the leader of the suffrage movement up here.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Hooker was the leader of the suffrage movement in Maryland. They all belonged to the old National American. So Mrs. Hooker's group, and of course that was because of this personal contact we had. It was so close to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
We went over to see Mrs. Hooker many times, and she invited us often to spend the weekend, to spend Sunday or something over there. And so finally her whole branch formally withdrew for the old National American over the question of what we would fight for and joined us.
Mm-hmm.
And then this New York one, as I told you, joined us, amalgamated with us,
mm-hmm.
when they gave up their own, just dissolved and recommend every member to transfer a membership to us. So we gradually got support, sometimes whole states and sometimes parts of states. But from that time, that year, I spoke in a great many places over the country, just to the local boards. I asked them if they would let me come and explain this. And I remember going to Ohio and that very foremost woman, lawyer. Do you remember who she is out in Ohio? One of the first women ever to hold a high judgeship position. Yes, Judge Florence Allen was her name.
Oh.
You probably know who she was out in Ohio. Well, she was on this board, and I think she was on the Court of Appeals of Ohio. A federal judgeship, and she had, I guess, the highest position in the legal field that any woman ever held in the country. I remember she was at this meeting, and I tried my best to explain it to them. And I remember at the end, someone said, well, I guess this was the president, whoever it was. She said, I think it's been very interesting to hear all this. And I think that we all feel that we better stick to our knitting. Remember a word so well, which was to stick to what they were doing. And even Judge Allen didn't speak up for us.
Yeah, she meant the Shafrock-Palmer Amendment.
Yes.
Yeah.
So as we went over the country, we got to know the women, and every place we got some friends, I think. So gradually, to our amazement, while we hadn't expected to get another, we thought we would be another group that would independently work for this amendment. We hadn't started out to build an organization, because that's a hard thing to do. And when you get it, a hard thing to manage. Mm-hmm. And we really didn't want one. We wanted to get the existing National American to stop supporting the Shafrock Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
But the only result was that our own organization suddenly began to be an organization.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, up to 1915. And in 1915, Doris Stevens went across the country speaking in place after place, and Mabel Byrne had been going, and I'd mm-hmm. been going, and we'd gotten branches in one state. We went down to Texas and got this Rena Maverick Green to become, and got this Clara Snell Wolfe, who became one of the greatest supporters we ever had. She was the wife of a professor of economics in the at Austin, Texas.
Oh, really? What was her name?
Clara Snell Wolfe. And it's beyond words what she did. It's just impossible to estimate the value of her work. She's a very intellectual type. So then her husband was to just as a diversion. Her husband, her husband was transferred up to the University of Ohio as professor of economics, head of the economics department. So she went up to the University of Ohio. In the meantime, she'd decided that she would teach herself. And she'd gotten them, she had no children. She was an extremely intellectual type of a person. And so she studied, I've forgotten what, something, I think, and took her doctorate degree in it, and then got a position to teach in a college in Ohio, but not the same college as her husband. But they seemed to have all been under the same organization, in the same organization. So then came the Depression, and she was dropped on the ground that they couldn't afford in the Depression to employ two people in the same family.
Yeah.
And she was married, and she was married to this professor, and so she was dropped. And that went all over the country, you know, at that moment. I don't know how many places that happened. So she then just turned in and devoted herself to the Woman's Party, and did up until her death. She died about a year. 2 years ago, I guess.
Mm.
One of the greatest blows we ever had when she died. But these groups brought in, you see, people so that we gradually, when the local wouldn't support the Equal Rights Amendment, the Equal Suffrage Amendment, then we got a group of our own.
Mm-hmm.
Until we formed branches in almost all the states.
Some of your organization started out in 1913 because it's mentioned here that you had mailings to suffragists all over the United States about the suffrage amendment that you were going to submit. And they responded, and by the time Congress opened, which was in April of 1913, you had one woman from every congressional district in the United States on hand to give a petition to her Congress.
Yes, we did, I know.
Goodness, how did you do all that?
Well, that's what I said. We were so exhausted. Well, now you better ask me some questions.
Okay, let me go over this about the covering the years that you just talked about and see if I have any mopping up questions.
Is this light good enough for you?
Yeah, that's fine. Now, your amendment was introduced by Representative Mondale, who was a Republican of Wyoming in the House, and Senator Chamberlain of Oregon in the Senate. And he was...
Well, that was one year.
I think he was a Democrat. That was that year. So that the fight between the two amendments became known as the fight between the Shafroth-Palmer Amendment and the Mondale Amendment. And
we always call it the Bristow-Mondale Amendment. I don't remember Chamberlain.
Yeah, I wonder. Of Oregon.
Bristow was from Kansas, I think.
Well, his must have been the name finally assigned as the prominent.
Maybe it was afterwards. But it was usually known for the years. You'll find it in almost everything. Yeah. Said Bristow-Mondale Amendment.
Right, yes, it is.
And you see, when this confusion was so immense, confusion among the women and the confusion in Congress as to what these, why these two groups were coming up, and and of course it didn't last so very long, because I said as soon as the war came on, these other people all deserted and went into the war effort. And we had the field to ourselves. But that was 17, 18, and 17, 18, and maybe part of 19, that they weren't there. Till the war came to an end, they weren't there. But when this confusion was so terrific, we decided we'd have to change the name of the Bristow-Mondale and call it something that would be have some propaganda value, and that's when we decided to call it the Susan B. Anthony Amendment. Because she'd been one of the most prominent women in having it drafted and introduced.
Yeah.
And then to do that, we got up a pageant in Washington, which Hazel Mackay came down and did for us. I remember going up to see her in Shirley, Massachusetts, in the coldest little place that you ever saw, where she was living with her mother, and asked if she'd come down and put on a pageant to make people know who Susan B. Anthony was, so we could call this the Susan B. Anthony Amendment and people would know something about it.
Oh, yeah.
So she did come down, and we had in a very big hall in Washington a very beautiful pageant that she put on honoring Susan B. Anthony. And from that time on, we did it again and again and again and again. And we got a Susan B. Anthony stamp, you know, and we did everything to make people know who Susan B. Anthony was.
Oh, I didn't know you got a Susan B. Anthony stamp.
So then we called it the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, as against the Shafroth-Palmer, and it just was a device to simplify this campaign and make it easier for congressmen and easier for the women to know what they were backing.
Yeah. You had problems getting it out of the House committee in that Congress.
Well, we always had. We never, in the beginning, we never had any strength in Congress.
But you did get a report made to the Senate. That was the first favorable report in 21 years, I think. It came out in June. And then in June and July, the Congressional Union, had petitions circulated in every state. And then July 31st, when they arrived at the Capitol, you had another great big demonstration with a motorcade.
What year are you talking about now?
1913 still. And there was a big motorcade to the Capitol that started at Hyattsville and came down to the Capitol with all of these petitions for the amendment.
That's our first year, you mean?
This is your, this is 1913, your first full year. With a big demonstration of delegates.
Well?
And you met with the members of the Senate committee who made some speeches.
Where was this?
At Hyattsville, on the village green.
That wasn't anything very much.
But then they had a big motorcade down to the Capitol.
Yes, that was gotten up. We created something called,
It looks very big in the suffrages.
Anyway, the thing was, it wasn't one of ours, you know. It was in the effort to try to get women from the suffrage states, which we were then beginning. There was a Dr. Cora Smith King, who had been a prominent member in the winning of suffrage in the state of Washington. And she had transferred her practice to Washington, D.C., from Washington State. And she was an officer of the Washington State branch of
National American.
Of the National American, anyway, whatever group, or a great deal. Because she organized, as well as she could, getting some women from every suffrage state to come or send a representative for a delegation they were going to take down to Congress. Well, that was this one that she organized. Oh. She lived in Hyattsville, and she organized it out there.
Oh, I see.
And she brought it in, and it was very effective because these congressmen that they went to see, they were going to see their own congressmen, and they were themselves voters.
Yeah, yeah. I should think that would be terribly effective. I was just amazed that you could get everything organized over the United States. How did you locate all these women?
Well, Doctor, we turned it over to Dr. King. She said she would do it. And she got in touch with women in her own state. And they authorized her to represent them, and she got in touch with women, other states where women had the vote.
One thing that interested me was that Mary Ware Dennett accepted the key to the town of Hyattsville from the mayor, so she must have been in on this. Isn't she the woman who was on the board?
Yes.
With National American?
Well, this, in the beginning we worked, you see, much more closely together than we did later on.
Yeah.
This was the first year before this separation had become quite so definite.
Then you did have this.
You see, there were only a very few people like Mrs. Catt who seemed to have her heart very much in any animosity.
I see. Then the next month, August 13th, that was just 2 weeks later, was this National Council of Women Voters, which was made up of women voters from the suffrage states.
That's what now I'm telling you about.
That's what you organized.
Well, I wouldn't say we. We arranged to Mrs. King to get it organized, Dr. King.
Well, it seemed to have a president. Emma Smith DeVoe.
That's right.
And Jane Addams became the national vice president. Is that right?
Because they just got voting, right, presidential vote out in Illinois.
Oh, yeah. And they had a mass meeting in the Belasco Theater.
That's right.
Which was hot and crowded.
Yes. Well, we really got up all these things, did all this organization work. But we were helped by the fact that we could send out the letters in Dr. King's name and Mrs. DeVoe Smith, I think her name was.
Then I have another note here that in November, on November 17th, a delegation of 73 New Jersey women came in to see the president.
Yes, that was Mrs. Pikert. That's one of the things that Mr. Gallagher asked me about. I wonder why it's where that they get all that.
I think because it's written up in one of the books, and it's kind of cute because the you couldn't get a
well anyway,
an appointment, and so you went on over anyway.
I didn't go, but they did. But they came down. We'd asked them to come down because they were in the president's state. You know, we kept up these deputations.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody we could think of that might be a new group. And we thought, well, his own state women mm-hmm. might be good. So we asked Mrs. Pikert. She was a member of the old National American. This was that first year where everybody was a member of the old National American. The whole branch was.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I asked her. I remember it all very vividly. And asked her to come down, and she came. Then when they were there, I called up for them to announce that they had arrived and would like to see the president, and I was told that it was impossible because he was occupied and so on. And then we said, well, they will go over anyway and wait until he could see them. So then when they went, he did receive them.
Yeah.
It was just one of a repeated...
Of a lot.
Repeated deputations.
Yeah.
But by the time we got to all these deputations, he certainly knew that there was a widespread interest in the country. And what he'd asked us to do, the concert public opinion, we were trying to do. That was our point.
Okay. Another question I have is, would you want to tell anything about the problems of getting a suffrage committee in the House? The Senate formed a suffrage committee. The House continued to not form a suffrage committee, and they made you work through the subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee.
there wasn't much to say. I think that we thought it might be a good thing to have a special committee, but it, of course, didn't make much difference, so we got it done. As far as I remember, that we never did get a suffrage committee in the House, did we?
Well, you may have along about 1917 or so.
I don't remember whether we ever did or not.
Seems like I remember that from my reading. Another thing that interests me is that
you do a lot of things just in order to keep the subject going, and because I never thought it made much difference what committee through all the years, which particular committee. Yeah. But if you can make an agitation about a committee, you sometimes get to know friends and get new friends and so on. While they might not have been so anxious to get a report and have suffrage put in the Constitution, they might think, well, why shouldn't they have a committee? And so we'd had all these little devices, not that they were so important, but it was a sort of device to keep the thing alive.
I see. Another thing that you did was you had a suffrage school.
Yes.
And I thought that looked pretty impressive. I think.
Yes, I remember all about
it. Program. Here is. It's on page 42 of December 20th, 1913, Suffragist. And it talks of. There's a class in parliamentary law by Mrs. Nanette Paul, LLB.
Yes, I remember it all very well.
Elsie Hill.
These were all devices to keep the subject before the women of the country and to get them more informed, you know.
Well, this went on for several days.
And I know it did.
I wonder if it looks like an awfully good training curriculum here for anybody working in political organization work. You even have parliamentary law and class in vocal culture and public speaking and one in press work.
Of course, we didn't devote. I don't know that we ever had another session of it. We may have had, but we only did this again in the way of keeping this before the women. Because I know perfectly well you can't stop and devote yourself to the physical culture of your speakers and studying parliamentary law and so on. You just have to spend most of your time in the actual work before you.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, each one of these schools cost us a lot of time to make it a real success. But it was a good success. It was very, very successful.
And, well, you must have gotten new workers out of it.
Maybe one or two, not much.
Did you have very many of the schools? Did you have very many of the schools?
I don't remember how big a school it was. It wasn't supposed to be a big school. At that minute, they were having these separate schools all over the country. We weren't, but people were.
Mm-hmm.